We are. Sean, are you? Did you pre-plan the cold open again? Which is not what a cold open is.
Pre-plan.
What do you get a suggestion for the cold open?
No, I didn't pre-plan.
We could
it.
Get a suggestion for the cold open.
Basically, the cold open
can
is
we get
not
a suggestion.
It's
coal miners. Oh God, remember when those guys were in a mine?
Yeah.
Well, coal miners. I heard coal miners.
Mm-hmm. Are we already rolling here?
We've been rolling.
Yeah, so, we've been rolling like that whole conversation.
I'll take the suggestion. I'll take the suggestion of coal miner now. Now, coal mining is a dangerous job.
Yeah, just like improv.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah,
and sometimes you have to ask yourself, man, why am I doing this?
Just like improv.
And a coal miner is probably saying, well, I'm doing this for my family. I'm doing this to put food on the table.
Dad, we'll go to bed. Just let us go to bed. We're tired, Dad.
But I...
I don't want to learn any more lessons.
Why am I coal mining? Why am I doing this podcast? Why am I getting improv lung coming in here talking about improv for hours? This
Dad,
is the final episode.
We appreciate everything you do for
this
us, Dad.
This is the final episode. Kids,
it's bedtime.
This
we
is the final
it.
Episode unless you guys start going to the internet. I want to see... internet likes. I want to see iTunes reviews.
Your coal.
I want to see all. That's my coal. Is iTunes reviews. If I don't start seeing iTunes reviews, oh God help us all. This podcast will go away.
Well, thank you for keeping us warm at night with your improv coal.
And
No, I hate this.
And that is a long form conversation. Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell. Hello, Lydia Hensler. Hey, welcome to the podcast.
I hit my mic when I tried to clap.
I said your name, but I'll give you a slight introduction and then say your name again.
Okay.
And then we'll clap again.
Okay, and that time I won't hit my mic.
Lydia Hensler, amazing improv teacher, performer, been at the theater for shy of a decade, right? Just shy of a decade.
Ooh, just over a decade.
Just over a decade.
2004.
Absolute veteran, I'd say role model improviser, and just generally great person, Lydia Hensler. We'll clap again.
You guys! Just at the intro.
Well, just you
just
wait.
A really warm.
We've been
feeling.
On a little crying run on this.
Have you?
We had a little, some tears last
good
week.
Good tears or bad tears?
Good. All,
it's always good tears.
Oh, that's
tears.
Good.
Always good tears.
It's always good.
Except
tears.
When someone dies, that's usually bad tears.
But still,
oh, I meant on the podcast.
Just
always good tears. No, I don't think all tears are good tears.
Nobody's died in here.
No.
Nobody's
died. Well, there you go.
Not yet.
Yeah, no, I was totally talking about in here too. It just was. Did anybody die?
How is it over a decade? So you were a little baby girl when you got here.
I was a little baby girl when I got here. Wow. And now I'm 13.
Hold on. Let's get right into it. Nicole, we like to start our interviews the same way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nicole, you like to ask.
So, Lydia, before you took your first improv class at UCB,
yes.
Who were you, where were you, and
what
were
you
doing?
Oh, my God. You guys, this is so great. Okay, so who was I? Mm-hmm. I was a 19-year-old waitress who, and I'm calling myself a waitress because I went to musical theater school, but I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be an actor. But I was just waiting tables. I wasn't auditioning or anything.
So you were done with school and you were just...
And I was just waiting tables because I didn't want to sing and dance. But I had always wanted to do improv. But I didn't know that that's what it was. that it was a thing. I did improv in high school.
Yeah. What was your impression before then?
So I did these things. I was with the Mental Health Players of New York, which sounds like an improv sketch group name or something, but it wasn't. It was associated with the Mental Health Association of the Southern Tier of New York, up in Binghamton. And I did it in high school. And they would go to schools and church groups and companies and stuff and do improvised, not plays, but scenarios, I guess, about like sexual harassment and bullying and stuff.
Why? I that seems like something that somebody should have scripted out.
Why was it improvised?
If you have a bad show, you're just like sending a terrible message.
It's all my fault. No. We didn't want. It's not your fault. You didn't figure it out yourself.
Was the goal to be funny? No.
No, I would tend to make things funny. I would find humor in the darkness. Boy. And Bob DeBono, the guy that ran the Southern Tier Mental Health Players, he actually wrote one of my letters of recommendation, and that's what he put. Like that, I always found.
Humor
in the darker, even in the darkest of subject matter. But it was, but you would do actually a lot of very dramatic, like crying and tears and stuff. But I always found a little lightness there.
You have not answered the question.
Why was it improvised? I don't know.
Okay, maybe great. Just for
I
the
don't
entertainment
know. I think
value?
So that it, I don't know why was it improvised. We would get an outline though. It was like Larry David said. Like it'd be like, this is what's gonna happen. This is where you're gonna end up. We would rehearse.
It's
a little
interesting.
Bit.
I mean,
it is really interesting.
It is like when I think about it, there probably should have been lines, but I don't know. It was great, and then they'd open it up to questions a lot, and you create fun characters.
So was this your first sort of exposure to improv?
Yes.
And so even though the idea wasn't to be funny, you sort of connected with this because it was like it's off the cuff and like, what was the, because it's interesting, the first thing I thought about improv was this was really funny.
Yeah, right? I loved making it. I always wanted to be an actor,
right?
Like, and so I was, and I always was that person. Like I was, like, since my dad loves to tell this story, my first sentence was see self on big TV, because I wanted to watch home movies of myself on the television.
Wow.
But that's more, I think, just like a 3-year-old that needs a lot of attention. but I always knew I wanted to be an actor. So like even I remember like I was always performing like at recess. I started a singing group in elementary school, and I made us rehearse at recess, and I kicked a girl out because she wasn't serious enough. She was like on the tire swing when we were having our rehearsal.
Wait a minute.
I was like, you're welcome to, you know, I don't know what language I used. I was 6, but I was like, you can do that. You just can't be in the group.
Oh my God.
So anyway,
this does not sound like, well, anyway, we'll see what have the evolution to Lydia.
I was very serious about being an actor, and I loved it, and it was like my everything. And so I think I was drawn to anything that could get that I could do on stage. And I remember being in middle school and the mental health players coming and then being like, how can I do that? You know? And so then I inquired, and then I became one of those people that did it. And I just loved making stuff up, and I loved not having a script. It was so much more fun. It was better. And so it was really, really fun. So that was my first foray into improv, and it fit like a glove.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's a super unique foray into improv, because it's not comedy per se.
No. It wasn't supposed to be.
It's like supposed to be this serious thing, and just the act of making it up.
Yeah.
Felt fun.
Like truly, even though it was just like high school kids and like a couple other like regional actors or whatever, like just getting together on a Saturday or Sunday morning to rehearse these things. It was like, it felt, I don't know, this probably sounds really corny, but like, it felt like art. Like I got to do art.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in high school, and this is not a diss on Mrs. Goodman or Mr. Mullen, who are my drama teachers, and they were amazing.
Goodman, Mullen, not a diss.
Not a diss. But like, when you're just doing Guys and Dolls or Bye Bye Birdie or whatever, like, I was like, oh, this is art. We're saying something. We're being real people.
Right.
Like,
it kind of feels like you're going through the motions in some of those other things that you're doing.
You felt like, to me, it felt like movies. Like, you got to have all these intimate moments that I had not experienced on stage as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old actor, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I loved it.
So, you went to school for acting.
Yes.
You then are a 19-year-old waitress in New York.
Yeah. I went to musical theater school, and it was really quick. I went to AMDA, and I went like through the summer, so I was out in 18 months. So like by 19, I was
like,
just
I'm
like,
done.
I am in New York. Time to figure out how to be an adult.
So were you like auditioning for stuff and like?
No, I really wasn't. I wanted to be like, I had always like my grandmother was great at instilling in me the like celebrating the struggle, like the journey of it. Like she would say things like, you're going to be on your fire escape, like eating a bowl of ketchup and water as tomato soup. Like, sounds disgusting. Nicole, your face. And I never did have ketchup and water as tomato soup, but my grandmother, like, made the being a poor, broke, struggling actor part of the beautiful journey. And right. So I was like,
okay with it.
I was like excited about just like, I wanted to be a waitress that, you know, audition, but I wasn't doing the auditioning part. I was just waiting tables, which I found out is a common thing in the restaurant industry. Right.
Were you not getting the auditions or were you not pursuing them?
Not pursuing them.
Interesting.
Maybe I think, not knowing how to pursue them.
Yeah. I think I was just, it was like somebody just, it was like I was just plopped in New York and didn't know. Even AMDA at the time, and I'm sure it's fantastic now, but at the time, like, they didn't even really have dorms. Like, they rented out residential hotels. And so it would be like, oh, that girl's in my tap class and she lives on my floor. Oh, that woman's a prostitute and she lives on my floor. Oh. Like, oh, we're spending the afternoon with these Israeli drug dealers. That's cool. Like, it was so crazy. New York. Yeah, like, it was just, there was no meal plan. There was no, like, MetroCard plan. You were just like, you just had to, like, I was 17 and it was just like, you're in New York, figure it out. And so it was very,
that's insane.
I think I was very much still in the figure it out phase at 19. Like, I was through school so that it was like, okay, how do I pay my rent? Like, that, I think it's an animal of its own to like figure out how to be an adult who can take care of themselves. So, in my opinion, it didn't come naturally.
So then what?
I was working really hard.
What moved you to then pay the like $300 to take your first class? Did you see a show or what was?
Well, I didn't pay it. My parents gave it to me as a Christmas gift.
Oh, yeah. Everybody. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I didn't pay for
all my birthday gifts and like Christmas gifts were in front glasses.
Shout out to all the kids out there on that like January first class schedule. We're all doing it.
It is too. Totally. Like when you do like 101s after the new year and you're like, what moved you to take a class? And I'm like,
my
well,
dad's kind of from-
yeah. It's all just like Christmas gifts.
I think I still owe my parents. Technically. I think they fronted the money for the original Suck My Dick class in 2009.
Nice.
I'm pretty sure I still owe them like $500.
All right, we just figured it out.
We'll just put it on the list.
Yep.
Wait, so what was the question?
Oh, it was just like what the first thing you saw, like your first class or first show or?
Oh, this is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. So I met a girl doing extra work and which is crazy, by the way. Have you
extra
guys done
work,
it?
I've done it a couple times.
There are people who are like really serious about it, and like there's a whole hierarchy, and like people are like, I was doing this show the other day. It's like very weird. Yeah. Anyway, I met this girl, and like I was just like having a good time doing my extra work. I think it was on the set of it was like a TV movie. Gretchen Mol was in it. Oh, The Ballad of Betty Page.
Right? That's very funny.
And we were all wearing corsets. We were like in a church. You would never see our faces. We were just bodies. We were scenery. And it was like midnight, non-union, in a corset, like $60 for like a 12-hour day and like marks all over your body when you took your costume off. But anyway, I met her and she was like a groupie, like a UCB groupie.
Oh, she was just like coming to shows and like, I love
it. And she like knew some of the performers or whatever. Like, she was a total groupie. Mm-hmm. And then like we went, I remember, so she took me to ASCAT and I was just like, oh my God, this is what I want to do. Like, it was, I didn't know you could do it,
right.
You know? And I was like, this is what I want. Like, immediately. And then we went to McManus after and she was like, let's sit here. Like, the performers come here. And I realized, like, really quickly.
You're like, oh, no.
I did not have, like, great street smarts. But I was like, I got to get away from this chick.
Oh,
she's
man.
A groupie. And so
you got taken to the UCB by a crazy person.
I did. She was, like, real crazy. Like, and, wow. But she got me here. I don't remember her name or anything because I cut my ties real quick with her.
Do you remember who was at that first ASCAT?
I don't remember anything about it. I just remember
it was
that
just kind
feeling.
Of like a weird like night where you're like, you're going into it like not thinking this is going to be the beginning of the rest of my life.
Yeah,
you just are like, well, what is this? And like,
yeah, but it instantly it was like a visceral like, that is what I want to do.
What year was
this? Is everything 2004? I think
2004.
It might have. I can't remember. It probably like 2004. It might have been 2003, and I couldn't do it until 2004 or whatever. But yeah. I think fall 2004. So
you see that show, you leave McManus horrified that this person exists.
No, or you're painting a terrible picture.
No, you just are like, this is not my scene, basically.
Well, it's like there's doers and then there's clingers, right? And it's like you want to be a doer.
And you're like, immediately like, I need to look into this.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. It was immediate, yeah. And then that was what I wanted for Christmas. And,
right.
Yeah.
So.
Who was your 101 with?
There we go.
Will Hines.
Ooh.
I took
original
my,
host.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I took my 101. I signed up with Owen Burke, and I signed up back when the offices were on 23rd Street, and you go upstairs
with
and you give
check.
Your check, and the class took place just in the office, like in that big room in the back, and I signed up with Owen, and Owen couldn't do it at, like, I think he had Will sub like once or twice, and then Will just took over the class. I think he, you know,
something.
Career was blown
up.
Will was my first teacher, and I was his first class.
Oh, wow.
So it was really cool.
That's the same with me and Kevin. We have the same first class, first.
Twinsies. Yeah. Heinzie twinsies.
So that's awesome. Do you remember experiences from that class? Did you love it away?
We had a really good class. We had a lot of people that had experience, and it was really fun because it was like everyone was excited about it. And I remember Will just talking to us like we were equals. Like he was just very like, I remember him saying one time, he's like, well, we're all writers here, right? So here's what we're, and I was just like, oh, wow. He's like.
He's really good about that. That's something I've tried to articulate for a while, but he does talk to people like they're equals, and it like empowers you.
I think it was helpful teaching because Will hired me, and he also, like, every time I would get, if I got like a little nervous about a certain student, or like, he was like, they're adults, like they're adults, you know, like we're all the same. And it was just really, you know, because I was in my head like, I need to make sure I'm nurturing everybody,
and
it's like, no, I don't. Like, if you don't, you know, I can't, whatever, take the
I'm
time
I'm not your
to,
mom, I'm not your dad.
That's it, yeah.
Basically.
I'm not your mom, I'm not your dad,
I'm your
a teacher.
Yeah.
So, and then I remember a lesson that Owen taught me in that class that, like, on one of the days that he was there, that was, like, I was just playing poker. And it's so simple. It's just the, like, talk about something else, that, like, exercise. But I was playing poker in my scene. And he was like, hey, so, you know, just, like, try, because I don't think there was a curriculum back then. And he was just like, he was like, most of the time in life, right, we don't, you know, we don't talk about what we're doing while we do it. So just talk about something else while you play poker. And that was like, whoa.
Then you immediately became a real person on stage.
Yes. Yeah, and I was just like, oh, right. Like it was so easy, simple, but like mind blowing at the same time. Oh, and then the last thing that Owen said that was not the last thing he said.
Before he died.
Someone died in this room, I told you. He's still with us. And is amazing. He's like a superhero comedy genius. Mm-hmm. He said this stuck. This was one of the most amazing things he said, was he talked about his grandfather who sold scrap metal. And he said that he just wanted to be of use. I hope I'm saying this story correctly and that it's not like some fable and I just made it part of his family. But this man sold scraps metal and to provide for his family, and he just wanted to be of use. He wanted to be of use to his family. And that's how we should approach the stage. We just need to be of use.
Oh,
and,
that's very interesting.
It was so great. I think it was a really great foundation for our class. I don't know how it would have been any other way, because there were really wonderful people in that class. But the whole class had a huge sense of service about it. And so you were always fine just being, you know, if you were walking on, like, just serving your purpose. It wasn't about you at all. And it was very, like, it was just great. Yeah, you felt like you were doing something bigger.
Yeah. It's like a mind shift of, like, this isn't about individual attention. It's about the whole, like, being of, that's a totally great note.
And I believe it's like we're creating magic, so we have to, like, trust our intuition about what our role is at that moment to make it magical.
And that does, to me, when you say that note, I'm like, oh yeah, that seems like something that Lydia probably got early and, like, took to heart. Because you're, like, an extremely useful improviser.
Thank you.
Like, I always do analogies to, like, sports. And in baseball, there's...
You said that like it was going to be news to anybody.
All right. This might be news to Lydia. But you can call, like, a baseball player a five-tool player. And that means that they can, like, defend, hit, and, like...
Use a wrench.
Basically do everything. Use a wrench, right? And I feel like you come from that sort of... You're cut from that cloth. And some of the teams you've been on are full of those people.
Yeah,
maybe it's
I've
just
been
like
very lucky.
Yeah.
So let's jump to that. Mm-hmm. I think unless
are the, I mean, yeah. You went through the classes pretty quickly, or was it like, you know?
Yeah, I had. I mean, it was really just like when I could cobble together the money, or so it wasn't. I wasn't lucky enough to go immediately mm-hmm. after, but like within a couple months in between. Or
were you going to shows all the time? Did you like immediately make this your life in the improv nerd way, or were you just like kind of taking classes and doing other
things? Couldn't afford to financially, and just also I had like a bunch of personal stuff going on, and mm-hmm. so I couldn't, like, I always say that too when people are like, oh my god, I'll miss a step, and I'm like, we're always gonna be here. And yeah, that was an AMDA thing. A teacher, when we were like going out into the world, was giving a speech. He was like, the industry will always be here. So like if your mom is sick or something, deal with real life, because this is always here. And if this is your life, then that's what you're doing your whole life. So take care of what makes you a good person.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had like some personal stuff going on. And so that was always my priority. And then I just did this at my own pace. Yeah. I mean, I was in love with it. So it was like when I could do it, that's what I wanted to do. Right. But I couldn't really afford to get obsessed.
Did you have some classes that were like, oh, I'm starting to get really good at this? Or did you always feel like you were, I mean, you had some prior improv experience and performing experience. So was there ever like setbacks? Did you ever have those moments of like, oh, I can't do this, I shouldn't do this?
No, I think I remember having like, I just had great teachers. Yeah. And I was so lucky to have good classes.
Yeah.
I remember learning a lot. Like I remember two instances that were really good light bulb moments. One was in my 301, there was this guy who talked about, I always give this example in class all the time. Mm-hmm. There was this guy who always talked about NPR every time he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he didn't, but he, like, he literally wouldn't respond to it. You'd be like, oh, Dad, thanks for making me pancakes or something. And be like, on NPR today, they were talking. Like, he wouldn't. Like, he wouldn't. He just didn't hear you. He drove all the way in and listened to NPR, and then he would just talk about whatever was on. He just wasn't, like, getting it mm-hmm. yet.
Was maybe he not getting it, or did he work for NPR? And was it, like,
this is like a embedded? Weird ad.
I don't know. I mean, we all wound up with tote bags by the end. I don't know. I mean, God, save Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. But so... And I saw this girl, Terry Riley, this woman, Terry Riley, who was on my my first indie team, and she just chose to love that about him and, oof, like, started this scene. He wasn't yes-anding at all, and she was like, oh, God, you're so smart. I love how smart you are. It's such a turn-on, all the things you know.
Then it immediately became a scene that he could participate
in. It was amazing. And, like, she got into a hot tub at one point. He just kept talking about NPR. She started blowing bubbles at him. Like, she heightened and explored the entire game, like, fully on her own in a way that made everything that he did perfect.
Yeah.
And I was just like, because he was the guy people were like, I don't want to step out with. And I watched somebody step out with him and kill it. And it was just like, that was another thing Owen Burke said, like, you have to fall on the grenade. You got to jump on the grenade. You have to jump out whether you want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's the deal, you know? And I watched her do that and be so successful. I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then I can't remember what the other, like, oh, and the other one that, the other light bulb moment that I couldn't remember was being in a 401. And I don't think I had the firm grasp on game yet, or like, it was very hit or miss. And I just remember being in a scene. And I said I was in a locker room and that I just came there for the camaraderie. Like, that was my justification. And and then it was like a tag run. And I just didn't get that should be the reason that I do everything that I was being tagged in about. I just didn't get it. And Chris Gethard was my teacher. I took him for 301 and 401. And he was like, he just stopped. He's like, wait. Why did you say you did that in the first one? And I told him, and I was like, camaraderie. He's like, do it again and again and again. And I was like, oh, like, it just everything twisted together. And I was like, yes. And so, I mean, I've definitely had challenges and it'd been hard, but,
you had some good teachers,
great teachers,
good classes,
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first team situation. So you were on,
unless I'm wrong, you've been at UCB for over 10 years and you've been on two house improv teams.
Yeah.
That's insane. It's insane. I thought about that this morning. That's fucking insane.
Oh, yeah, that is pretty crazy.
Thanks for thinking of me this morning.
So, Bastion, how'd that happen? And what was your path from finishing the class system into Bastion?
So, my So in classes, I was from classes. We formed a team called Big Tobacco, and
oh, yeah.
we were
been mentioned on the podcast before.
Well, hell, we were an 11-person indie team. And
how did you not have a coach who told you that was dumb?
I don't know. We were so excited and wanted to be inclusive. So we had an 11-person indie team. But, you know, it's great because you always have like 8 or 9 people there. Mm-hmm.
So was this wasn't your first indie team. You had done
it was.
This was your first
indie team. This is my first
indie
team.
And only indie team.
And only indie team.
Jesus, Lydia. Okay.
It was my first and only indie team. And, yeah, we did Big Tobacco. We won the first indie cage match, you guys. That's like a stat.
Which was like
the first
one
ever.
To get into DCM?
No, I don't know.
Indie cage match.
Yeah, what was
it? It was
that?
Like the very, it was just the very first one. It was in like 2006.
So there was an indie cage match before the indie cage match that
it
we
was
know
just
now?
Like one night, I think, or like round. I honestly don't remember, but I have the postcard somewhere.
That does sound familiar.
It was like was the first time they ever tried something mm-hmm. like that.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was so fun.
And you guys won.
Yeah.
And people on that
I did a handstand in the show. I remember being like, oh my God.
Applause break?
I don't know if there was an applause. I just remember being like, I did a handstand. Like all those people helped me dive off a diving board. Like it was just a cool physical moment.
Do you remember? Let's try to name some of the people on this team.
Oh, so Brandon Gardner.
Brandon Gardner.
I'm done.
Brian Foss. Mark Gessner, who if you don't know him, in the UCB system, he is like famous now. He's in every commercial and he's going to be on Bender's, Dennis Leary's new show, and he's like a little guardian angel of mine.
Awesome.
Mark Gessner. Philip Chorba was in Silver Linings Playbook and he's doing really well and does like lots of stuff as
well. So this 11-person team didn't... Yeah.
It was powerhouses. Powerhouse. Yeah, it was great. Steve Slate, who we all know, and then Lauren Hobbs. I don't know if you guys know her. She's
name.
Hysterical. Yeah. Terry Riley, who moved back up to Boston, Jacob Knoll, Hal Phillips, two more, myself. Uh-huh. I'm missing one person. This is the worst scenario.
Wait,
why did you guys have me name people? This is why you
don't put 11 people on
to
the
miss
team.
One person.
If there were 8 people on this team, you'd be done. Now.
No.
It wasn't.
Brandon Gardner,
was
Brian
another
Foss.
Bastion person?
Oh, Sean Clements.
Sean Clements.
That's
okay.
So here, duh. Sean Clements. Brian and Brandon and Sean and Brian very quickly got put on Herald teams.
Right.
And that like it was it just like everyone just kept leaving us for Herald. They
so
basically
this,
or
was
moving
this
on
through
with their
auditions?
Lives, so it got smaller
Were you
smaller.
Auditioning before then?
I think Foss was put on. Mm-hmm. And then Brandon and I got on together, and I think Sean was put on. And then Brandon and I got put on Bastion together. I auditioned. Oh, I always like to tell this story when auditions come up because I don't want people to get in their head. I auditioned twice, and my first audition was I just watched a sunset as my scene. Mm-hmm. Like, I was so nervous. Me and Phil did our scene together, which should have been great because we performed all the time together. And so it should have been really easy. And we stepped out, we watched a sunset, and we just like watched it set. We made like no choices. We were like, what a beautiful sunset. Yeah. Like, I don't even think we knew who we were to each other.
Oh,
I just remember
God.
Us having our arms around each other, watching a sunset for what felt like hours, but was probably like 30
minutes,
seconds
yeah.
or something. And then Anthony King just be like, edit.
Oh,
it was just
man.
Like, it was. Like,
were you devastated after the audition?
No, I used to call people on Herald teams the professionals, and I just never thought I would be a professional.
Really?
Like, I was so in awe that I didn't, I just auditioned because other people were auditioning.
Right.
I felt like I needed more time to cook, which so did everyone on the panel.
Right. That's interesting.
And then the second time I auditioned, my friend Phil, again, I told you I had like personal stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, that was my priority, was just like getting things together.
Right.
And my friend Phil said he had a dream about me that I auditioned for a Herald team and got on. And I was just like, And I just took that as like a weird sign and went and signed up. And then I auditioned and I got on.
Wow.
And it was the best. Me and John Murray have talked about this more than once, where it was like one of the best scenes we've ever done. We did in our audition.
Wow.
It was just a weird kismet. Like we stepped out together and it was awesome. And we both got on a team together and it was so fun.
That's fascinating. And it was the same team. So, all right. Let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Bastion. Your first Herald team. A lot of those, everyone's first Herald team?
Yes.
And ran for what? Four years. 4 years?
Yeah.
Good Lord. Longest running Herald team?
Yes.
Wow.
Sandino was like nipping at her heels.
Was getting close. Wow. That's so crazy.
Yeah. That was great.
So I have a question here from an audience member, and this is from Cameron Azarm. Azarm. Did you expect Bastion to last as long as it did? Like when it start, what was your expectation when the team started?
I had no expectation. I just didn't want to fuck it up. Like I had no expectation. I just wanted to not be nervous. That was my big thing, were my nerves. So I just wanted to be like not shaking on stage.
Were you a nervous player going in? You think?
On show nights, like in rehearsals, I was fine. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, I don't know. Yeah, I was nervous. I was really nervous. I always say this in class, like if you zoomed in on my hands, like while I was doing object work on stage, they'd be shaking.
Wow.
Like it took me a while to get it out of that. And I remember, this is a funny story. So I remember Anthony King gave everybody personal notes. It was like this amazing thing. He took time to like go to Herald Night, watch everyone and send everyone personal notes. For whatever reason, I didn't get the email that he was doing that. So I thought
my email was just me.
And like, I was like, oh God. And I emailed Molly or texted Molly or something. And she's like, no, everybody got that. It's like, it's totally fine. I was just like, oh God. I remember I was like temping at the Directors Guild or something as a receptionist and just being like, I can't even answer the phone. I was so scared by my email. But it was great. And he talked about my nerves. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what can I do to combat it? Because he was just like, when you get nervous, it's really bad news. Everything goes off course. When you know what you're doing, it's great. And so I found, I think, like, again, I'm like bastardizing quotes and stories, but I think it was Jason Mantzoukas. I don't know what the quote was or what the interview was for, but I found it online and him talking about just like basically fake it till you make it. And he was like, mm-hmm. if you walk out there and you say gibberish, but you do it with confidence, the audience is laughing. And if you they're laughing and before they realize you've moved on before they realize they were just laughing at nothing.
Yeah.
And he was like, but if you go out there and execute like the perfect game move, but you're nervous about it, it won't hit. And that was my experience. I would like kind of know what to do, but I'd be so scared to do it that it would not go well.
Mm-hmm.
That's a phenomenon I noticed with like advanced study students sometimes who like I'm watching and I'm like, you're technically so solid and you're saying things that are really funny, but it's not getting a response from the audience. And often it's because they'll like trail off at the end of the thing that
Ooh,
they're saying.
Yeah.
Or they'll like undercut it or they'll use like sort of fallback phrases
mm-hmm.
yeah.
as opposed to just ending it hard like it's a laugh line.
It's
so interesting.
And they won't, and they'll like not be confident in it being funny, like showing that.
Yes.
The audience doesn't, they're immediately like, well, is this funny?
They're
right.
Scared for you.
Yeah.
That's what I've noticed. I feel like improv audiences are, there's so much grace there. They're rooting for you. Like I feel like they get that it's kind of magical and really mm-hmm. hard and that you're making it up. And because you're making it up, you have wiggle room that like a stand up wouldn't have.
Right.
And I feel like, but if you're scared, they just get nervous for you and then they can't laugh because they're too worried being nervous for you.
Yeah, nobody but a monster would pay money to go to an improv show to not enjoy themselves.
Yeah,
right?
That's a pretty horrible
thing. I think we kind of forget that.
Yeah.
Because we think like they have to be won over, but like most people are
like,
going because they thought they were going to like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, people like take their bachelorette parties and stuff. They don't do it because they're like, this will be horrible.
Yeah.
So Bastion had not a ton of lineup changes, but you had lineup changes.
Yeah.
Do you think of them as eras of Bastion over those 4 years, or does it feel like one long team?
Bet you consider like coaches eras of Bastion.
I don't.
Does it all feel like one long
team? It just felt like a, I'm so like, sometimes I hear myself and I'm like, oh God. I was like, it just felt like a journey. It really did. It just felt like a really beautiful journey.
Well,
was there ever a time during that, because it's your first team.
Yeah.
4 years is a long time. Did you ever get stir crazy or curious? Because there are people who've been on good teams and have asked to leave those good teams just to have new experiences.
I think we did a good job when we would get like stale in any way of mixing it up. And usually it was mixing it up with a different goal or a different coach. And there was this real sweet spot where we had been together, I think like 3 years, where we got into all this thematic stuff with Chris. And mm-hmm. it was like incredible.
Yeah,
like I just couldn't believe mm-hmm. it.
I remember seeing that and being like, oh, this is not the same Bastion.
Yeah.
This is a different strategy.
Yeah, it was right when Eric Tenoy joined the team, too.
Yeah,
it was like we had, I think that was our first, or no, that wasn't our first lineup change because Maggie moved to LA and we got Abra. So we, but it was the first lineup change since Abra came in. And because Abra came in that first year, it felt like
she was
very core, right?
I didn't realize it was that early.
It was pretty, I think it was the first year. Yeah, it was pretty early. And so, maybe a little after, but. But yeah, and so that was like a big shift, and it was just great. It was like Eric had left Herald Knight, and he came back. And I think there was that was also like a really happy moment because it was like, wow, this guy is so good. He's been around for so long, and he wants to play
be on
with
this
us.
Team, right?
Like, it was, you know, I think we were like, whoa, he wants to play with us, and Chris wants to coach us again. Like, he was our first coach, and he was so great, and like put us on such good footing. And then here we were, like a couple years later, maybe 2-3 years later, and he was back, and we all wanted to be ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just did like the coolest stuff. I remember I worked as a, I had so many friggin' day jobs, and I worked as this like swim teacher, and I was in chlorine, like I was in water like hours and hours a day. Mm-hmm. I was like always sick. But I remember coming to rehearsal with like wet hair and be like having the time of my life, because it was like the feeling of when I was saying in high school, where I was like, oh my God, I'm doing art. Like
that's
what that felt like. It was like always a joy to be on Herald Knight. Loved doing it. Loved all of it. Even like the trappings and nerves of it. But like, this was like, we're artists.
I remember a specific show in that era, I would say maybe, where I think everyone was a different level of drunk.
The Tequila Herald.
And John Murray was like really, really pushing it to the point where people were like, this is crazy.
We called his wife.
We called his wife
in
on the
show.
Phone. That was like I remember seeing that and being like, this would have never happened if Gethard wasn't coaching them right now.
Did Anthony King come on stage during that show?
He was amazing. It was so cool because we were doing something so outside the box and like different. And we were all like flying, you know, you're like, oh my God, this is happening right now. And you're just like in it. And I remember, the second beats, like Brian and I think it was Avra came out and they had waters.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second beats, like, you know, height and how sober they were. Mm-hmm. He had run to the, you know, the bar. And then in the second beats, Anthony King for the second beat ran up and gave them beers. And it was just like, it was such a cool, in the moment of the show, the artistic director of the theater,
yeah,
it was like he was being like, keep going,
yeah,
you know,
really
thumbs
cool.
up.
Yeah.
It was, that was a dream, Herald.
That was a really good show.
People thought that John Murray was drunk.
I mean,
I was like, didn't you remember the very beginning
where they
said
we
were
drunk?
All sober and we said he was drunk?
But I would say of all the committed drunks on stage, I've seen a bunch. I'd say that might have been the most crazy because they called us. I mean, he was throwing his body around on stage. It was crazy.
I think that was the only time Bastion ever did anything meta, and it was so awesome,
because
it was meta but still committed, because we were like, he was drunk, but then we kept pretending that we still needed to do a scene.
Yeah.
You know, I remember there was this time where he this funny moment where he was like glomming on to me, wouldn't stop touching, and I started yelling. I was like, I want to go analogous, I don't want to do this anymore. And then all of a sudden I look over and Oscar, he goes caw-caw, and just became a bird and just like made it analogous. And I was just like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, and so we did the scene.
That was a really, really good show. And yeah, I do remember at that point, because I think Bastion maybe had the reputation before then of being the like workman, like go in, do the Herald and like play game and
textbook.
No bells. Yeah,
yeah.
Completely textbook.
Technically proficient,
and everyone was useful. And then to see Bastion sort of take this like almost abstract, weird kind of turn was interesting, and probably a testament to why you guys were able to be a team for so long.
And I also think had an added element of respect because you were known for being like textbook and like solid. And I think it was a little bit of like, cool, man.
They've earned the opportunity to do this, right? Do you have other, like, also, didn't you guys like practice twice a week or something?
We were
for a long
insane
time?
For a long time. We practiced
This doesn't happen anymore, by the way.
No, and I don't know if it should. It's too much rehearsal.
Was it too crazy?
I feel like at the time it felt like this is the most important thing in our lives, you know. But it was, we rehearsed, you know, 3 hours a week, and then we would also rehearse 2 hours a week on Sundays. So where we would just run Harold. So 3 hours a week on Wednesdays, where we would run like whatever it was we were working on, mm-hmm. and then 2 hours a week we'd run Harold on Sundays.
That I am generally against. Teams doing 2 hours a week, two practices a week, because I feel like it ends up being more show than substance. Mm-hmm. Like they don't actually get that much out of it. That is the smartest take on it I've ever heard.
Yeah.
To do like an actual 3 hour practice and then it's just 2 hours of logging sets. That's really smart.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know who came up with that split.
Take
I mean,
it for all like of a Bastion. Group. Yeah. Take it on behalf
all,
of Bastion.
On behalf yeah. of Bastion, I accept that compliment. But yeah, it did make a ton of it was a lot of rehearsal, but it was like it was super organized.
Yes.
And proficient.
Well, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. But because then you got 3 full hours of exercise.
Yep.
And then you implement Harold's. It. Yeah. yeah.
And not then 2 hours of like additional exercise. It's almost half done. It's like you know what those 2 hours are for.
First Lady did that for a little bit.
That's smart.
But it became too much. But they were trying to do 30 Harolds in 30 days. So they were doing indie shows and practicing twice a week. It was way crazier.
That's cool, though.
That is cool. It's fun having goals like that.
But it's just interesting because I hear about that work ethic from that Bastion team, and I'm like, wow, that's. I wonder if there's a Harold team that would have that thought, or if. I don't know. I feel like just things are different now.
I think we just want people to be too busy, but I mean, I think it's part of like having a community filled with like talented, busy people.
People are too busy.
Nobody who's going to get on Harold Night is going to have 5 free hours in addition to Harold Night. Yeah. It's just not, or not nobody. No combination of 8 people will have the same 5 free hours.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing. We all did show. We were almost all of us always there for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, time makes you, like, Bucky was our best when we were doing practice, Harold Night, Wednesday night, hour-long show, Wednesday night jam.
Yeah.
Like, we were doing so much in 2 days.
We'll
get to the jam.
That was the best we were ever going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
Just that time together.
I think that's a cool thing to think about, though, and remember, is because, like, I say this in my advanced classes a lot, like, everything is, it's all finite. Like, the whole idea of what we do is, like, that it disappears. And I think, like, the rise and falls of teams and the levels of dedication and the time commit, it is always waves and it's always disappearing because it is that. Like at a certain point, like people are going to start booking stuff. Like you just, everything just, people get married and they have kids, like life just changes. And so there's just going to be like, there's going to be the Tequila Harold and it's going to go away. Like it is not sustainable.
Yeah.
It might be with a different crew or a different whatever, but
we're always chasing the highs, basically.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But I think it's just knowing that then you're not comparing yourself to who you were, who you like. It's easier to know that it's like constantly changing.
Right.
And just to be fully present when it's happening.
Yeah, because it's a joy. Like it's a joy, but you can't take it with you. Like you can only take the feelings with you and the memories.
You can only talk about them on podcasts.
You can only podcast about it, you guys.
So Bastion ends.
Yes.
What did you feel like it was coming?
Yeah.
Great.
I think we all felt like it was time and like it was coming. I think we had our like that amazing organic thematic period, and then when that started to wane. We just got back into just doing like good hair. We were just like, it started to wane. And it was like, all right, reset, which I also think is something that happens all the time. You try out crazy stuff. You do it in practice and it's really great. You do it on stage. It's not so great. You do it in practice. Then you do it on stage and they're both really great. Mm-hmm. And then it starts to break down and then you got
to
reset.
Yeah. I think that's also really smart and goes back to what you just said, which is rather than be like, guys, come on, we were doing that thematic stuff. Why is it going away?
Yeah.
Being okay that like, that happened, and for whatever reason, that's not where you're at anymore.
Yeah, I think you can't hold too tight.
Yeah, that's great.
Anything. And so we were like, we just want to have fun. And also, like, we had a couple personnel changes within that. It was like, let's just reset and just have fun, Harold. And I think we knew, like, we'd hit our peak and, like, we would probably be mixed up. Mm-hmm. And so even though it was, like, bittersweet and scary, because those were the only 8 people that I had performed with for, like, 4 years. And I wasn't like it is now. Like I was saying, I had, like, family stuff and whatever going on. So it was, like, I wasn't doing tons of shows outside of that. So, like, these were my people. And I was nervous to start anew, but ready at the same time. I have this thing I say all the time, which is, like, I'm entirely ready to do something when I'm just the slightest bit willing. Mm-hmm. Like, I will never, no one, I don't think anyone's ever like, I'm ready. It's just like, if I'm a little bit willing, then we're ready to go.
Right,
you know?
Right,
so
right.
I was like, I was nervous, but it was time. And I was ready for the next journey.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So then, was that the January shakeup?
That sounds right. Yeah, because we all took pictures in fur coats.
Right. So I think that was where we all woke up one morning and the teams were just done. And
yeah.
Then I think Bastion had a final show. So you wake up one morning. I want to say it was January 6th. Don Finelli and Laura Wilcox would probably know better because this is when they started dating because Opera just got broken up. So you wake up and you're on a brand new team.
Now, yeah, this is a little gossipy. What we just said.
What?
Not
gonna
lie.
About just
the whole date.
Guys, who else was dating in 2007?
I will say,
what are we talking about?
On, slightly gossipy.
Not gossipy.
That's maybe the worst.
They're married.
Word. They're married. I know.
I could do way worse.
I'm only kidding.
And this is to the community. I could do way worse than gossiping about married couples.
Okay. All right. Let's move away from there.
So you wake up. You're on a brand new team.
To the community.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what I'm. I don't know what the threat is for.
Yeah.
But I just want people to know.
Know that
I
can do it, and then
this is a scary threat.
Do my
Ben
bidding?
Is scary.
I don't know. Anyway,
so you wake up, you're on a brand new team.
Yeah.
What's the first feeling?
Wait, were there auditions or was it?
No,
just...
it was out of nowhere, right? I'm pretty sure January 1 was like because this was the period of time during which like Dybbuk happened, and then there was after like 4 months.
I honestly don't have like vivid recollections about that. Like. It coming.
Yeah.
I think we all knew it would happen. And I don't remember being, I remember not being surprised, just being nervous about whatever's next. I honestly, I was just like happy to still be on Herald Night. I was like, yay, I'm still here. And the first thing I did was just, I don't remember. I don't know if I emailed the whole group. I know I texted Abra and Molly and Abra, Molly and I and Eric were all going to Grandma's Ashes. So that was exciting. Mm-hmm. We'd still be together. But I remember just texting them, like taking their temperature and how they felt. And, you know, and I think it was bittersweet. Like we loved each other so much and we were moving on and we loved each other so much. Mm-hmm.
And who were the other four in original Grandma's Ashes?
Okay.
Paul Welsh,
Brandon Scott Jones, Megan Neuringer, and Ryan Carles.
Wow.
Yeah. We had crazy personnel turnover like in the first
right at the
year
beginning.
So fast.
You had,
so
like,
much.
A week of Phil Jackson.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was that week of
Phil Jackson
as well.
Week.
Yeah.
There was Paul left and who replaced Paul? Patton?
So let's see. So Molly left and we got Winston, I think.
And Molly went to
Badman,
right.
And then we got Winston. And then. And then did Paul leave next? I don't remember.
Might have been.
And Paul. Then I think Paul left next. And then Patton came on. Or Morgan.
Or Drew.
Drew was our final.
Oh, Drew was the last piece.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, boy, did we wanted him so bad.
Oh, really?
We loved him so much. We wanted him so bad.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Great.
That's not Gosby, right?
No.
That's just
you,
love.
That's you saying something that you felt.
Yeah. I mean, we wanted everybody
okay.
so bad.
Think,
we, like, begged
think,
for the people that came
okay, I'm just
on
gonna,
board.
I take
so
a little
really
bit of
lucky.
Offense with the way that we're defining gossip on this podcast.
Okay.
Right.
I don't know. It
I'm
just
I'm
feels
kidding.
Weird when you're, like, talking feelings.
Yeah.
But anyway, we all, like... Yeah, we were really, really lucky that with each, I think a lot of this, a couple of things I would credit, like for why all the changeover was so fluid and easy. One, I kind of think we all just had a really happy mentality going in because we'd all been doing it for so long and we were sort of like, let's play, like,
yeah,
let's have
yeah,
fun.
Yeah.
So
you had learned how to be on a team successfully.
Yeah.
So it was easy to bring those practices into a new team.
Yeah. And I think we had sort of like we're going to have a good time. We're not going to get weird about it, you
right.
know, and or stressed. And I think like Ryan to me felt like a really big part of that because he had been performing for so long and he had such a warm, welcoming energy. Like I just had so much respect for him. And then. To talk about treating people like equals, like he was just so down for everything and so
right.
open and kind and such a great performer. I was just like, oh, this is awesome. Like the most senior person here is like so into it and on board
that
and like celebratory.
That
kind
of reminds me of one of those things where it's like when you meet someone who's super famous but also super nice,
yeah.
you're like, what excuse does anyone else
yeah.
have to be a jerk if like Tom Hanks can be super nice? So like what excuse does any improviser have, if someone like Ryan Carles, who's been around for so long, can still be so accepting and such a good
teammate. And Megan, too. Like, Megan had been doing this for so long, and it was just like, everyone was just like, hey, new friend. Like, can't wait to, like, play with you. And it was so, it just felt so warm. And then Jordan Klepper was the, I think
Your first coach, right?
He was our coach, and he, I don't know if he was our first coach, but he was our main coach.
Right.
And, like, once we got him, we kept him. We wouldn't let him go. And he was, he was involved, I think, with every single turnover, maybe. Maybe save Molly because she left kind of early. But I like he was there, I think, for almost every turnover. And it was he would do all these like kind of like folding them in exercises when a new person came, which I would use when I coached Good Girl because they had a big turnover year.
And what exercises?
I didn't do this one with Good Girl, but where you like everybody has to lift someone up and like everyone does like a scene with that new person, like just fun, like kind of like trust Molly type fun stuff. I don't even remember half of them, but he was so joyous and he completely changed, I think, how I played for sure. And like he really helped mold us into who we were. It was like he gave us his blessing and permission to just have as much fun as possible. And he celebrated everything. And that was what was really cool. Because I think when we got him, we also, not that we were ever a team that would like Monday morning quarterback our stuff, which was a cool thing. I was like, oh, like we all just are like chill after shows and let it roll off our back. But he was like, he just celebrated stuff. Like he wouldn't, like he'd give a note if it needed to be given, but he was not looking to pick. He was looking to lift up and it just changed everything. Like I felt so confident and excited and like silly. Like I'd never played silly. I played like correct and I wanted to play fun. Like I had so much fun.
And that was the reputation of like Grandma's Ashes on Herald Night was like
fun.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the same fun. Like I remember so many people saying that of like, they're fun, but they're like doing the same fun.
Yeah, it was like all group, like group
just like
voice.
Yeah.
Total gameplay, but silly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Nobody said you were not playing game.
No. I'm saying it like that's why it was so fun and felt the same because we were all playing the same game.
Right.
It was just always silly. Yeah.
How long were you guys on Herald Night?
I don't know. A year or two, maybe somewhere between a year and 2 years, I think.
And then no lineup changes once you moved, right?
Yeah, we've been the same eight people for 3 years, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, on the weekend.
Talk about Kevin Hines asked a question, and he said, compare the strengths of Bastion and the strengths of Grandma's Ashes.
Oh, yeah.
Are they similar?
I was going to tweet back and just make a joke about us being able to do X amount of push-ups because I don't want to pick between my kids.
But I mean, did they share certain things that were good? I mean, maybe there's, you know, I think there's a way to...
I think the reputations are what, like, you're saying is pretty accurate. Like, Bastion was, like, super proficient. And, like, we were funny, but, we were technically... Like, I feel like we were textbook technically perfect a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But Grandma's Ashes, it felt like there was this thing. I felt like I graduated or something. It was like, oh, we know we're proficient. Go have fun. And so it was like I got to, or for me as a player, it was very transformative because I felt like I got to, I feel like I don't know how to really, I don't know how to compare the strengths as teams. I just know my journey through the teams. And I feel like my journey, it was like Bastion, I learned everything I could possibly learn about how to be like a strong, sturdy, of use player on stage, like on a house team. And then I got to like let that go
and know you always had it. Right?
Yeah. And not think about it or worry about it, just know it. And then I got to explore this whole other side of myself on Grandma's Ashes. And I often talk about this with my advanced students or 401 students, like when you're used to playing one way, about how to dabble your feet in like this other way of playing. Cause I feel like I also had to let the pendulum swing off. And like, it was really scary sometimes to be like, I'm playing a big character and I don't know why. I don't know my justification, you know, not have the homework done was really scary. But eventually the pendulum swings to the middle and then you have everything you need. But like, I had to go there and like play a lunatic art teacher who didn't seem to have
any philosophy.
Like any sort of through line about her. But
I do think that's like a pretty natural sort of growth period in improv is like, and I think students hang on to those rules so much early on, maybe to their detriment, you know? Like sometimes they'll do things that are technically right but not fun in a way. And then there's that moment where you sort of know the rules well enough that you can stop thinking about
them. You can blossom. Yeah. And I think that's that was my trajectory, both with the I think I had the right teams for the right times in my life.
Yeah,
I think that's totally true for everybody, right? Because like Bastion got broken up and we all went to other teams. So we all got to play in new ways. So but it was a perfect foundation for where I am now, for sure. And then Grandma's Ashes is just like a friggin' party every Saturday.
And also, you guys got to host the jam for a while.
That was awesome.
That was huge, right?
That was huge. We were so honored to do it, and we love doing it.
I'd say you guys brought back sort of, I'm not sure if you, were you the first to host it over at the Beast?
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys sort of ushered in this new era of like the jam being a huge part of the community.
Yeah,
it was huge.
It blew up.
It still is, but I mean,
because Ralph was like once a month, I think.
Yeah, it was once a month. And it had never been every week.
Yeah.
And then Grandma's Ashes took it over, which was a team that was almost built for the jam in the way they celebrated ideas, right? So it really, I mean, it did change the community in a way. There was this event every week. Everyone would go. And you guys probably, like, I don't know if you benefited from that experience or what
so
it was
much.
Like. Yeah.
I'm getting chills just talking about, like, hearing you talk about it, because it was, like, a really amazing moment in time. We did it for a year. We were the first people to, like, do it at the Beast. And we just learned as we went. But it was, like, that mentality of just, like, just celebrate, have fun. Like,
guys brought in Cypher Sounds, right?
Cypher Sounds. That was you guys. The jam.
Cypher was maybe Guthrie, the second team.
It was Guthrie?
I'm not sure. It wasn't.
Yeah, Guthrie and then Bucky.
Cool.
Right.
But yeah, he came to the jam, did the jam, and then he became the jam
ambassador.
That was amazing.
So when you were on Bastion, you said that like Bastion was your people because you were not super involved in the community outside of that. Was the jam part of you feeling like a bigger part of the community?
Yeah, I think like Grandma's Ashes and the jam, and just also being on like stronger ground personally. Like I just grew up, and I think like, it was just, I definitely felt more of a part of the community. Mm-hmm.
And I started teaching.
Yeah. I did this horrible day job called The Ride with like a bunch of UCB people. And that was really actually like, that was first that like where I felt like, oh, I'm like friends with all these people that I know and like admire their work, but I wasn't socializing.
Right.
I feel like I'm being like really elusive about the like things, like what was going on with me. I was just like, I stopped drinking and I needed to like learn how to
figure out how to live your life. Yeah.
I'm very like private about it, but oh well, it's on a podcast now. But it just seems weird instead of being mysterious. Right. So I was just getting my shit together. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got something. You got cookies, you got drinks, you got whatever. It's just life is hard. Life is hard and you use other things to deal with it. And sometimes those then kill you.
Right.
So you got to stop doing that.
And then you just got to go to the stage.
and you got to take it to the stage. But anyway, I can feel my face getting red because I am so private about it. Doing the ride, I felt way more a part of the community doing the ride. And that was so silly and stupid.
Right.
And it
was
so
fun. What
was
your part on the ride? Do you remember?
I played Jackie. I was one of the hosts. We all had the same name so that this computerized bus could talk to us.
Right?
And we just improvised the whole thing. And then it became like scripted, and then it became just basically a tour. But I had this really like bizarre experience with all of these fun, wonderful people of like my generation of improvisers. It was just a blast. And so I felt like I fit.
Right.
Then finally, and doing the jam was a blast.
Yeah, the jam really was a kind of throwback to like that crazy community feel.
Yeah.
Of like almost when we used to have those like parties at the old trade. Like there was this weird like everyone is here. This is the only thing that's happening. It's an event. It was really fun.
It was really good and everyone got to play and we would dance in between like while we were calling up all the names. We would dance.
Right.
It was just fun. We had like all these rules we had to read before each set because like it kept getting longer because people do insane things.
Right.
And they'd be like, hey, don't body slam people.
Don't tag someone really hard.
Yeah.
Which is still like,
what is the phrasing of the
gentle tap. Avra was like, just a gentle tap. And we had t-shirts. Kurt Gunther made us t-shirts. Mm-hmm. He's the best. And he made us these t-shirts, more jams, it would say, because Ryan would always yell that into the microphone. I mean, we all would, like, more jams, like, before every set. And on the back it said, just a gentle tap. But I believe the way we would say it was like, you know, if I can hear your tap, it's too loud. Yeah. Just a gentle tap.
I'll let you know. Still something that is said at the beginning of every jam.
I think Bucky never figured out if it was, if I can hear it, it's too loud, or if I can hear it, it's too hard.
Oh, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, I don't think we're saying
it's
exactly
semantics.
That way.
Like, just don't beat people up actually, when you're trying to do a scene.
Actually, what happens now is Cypher Sounds is there. Someone will say gentle tap, and then he'll play a sound that goes gentle tap.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Which is really fun. That's so fun. I remember I have, like, one real fun jam story, and it was just, like, when it just made me love the jam. And it was, I loved it anyway, but I was like, God, this is so fun and special. Mm-hmm. It was these two people were doing a scene and they were like on the high seas. And I actually always bring this up when I'm teaching about justification and how mm-hmm. you can make anything okay. Like, always say yes. So these two people were on the high seas, and someone I think with like less experience and like was nervous walked in the scene, like obviously didn't hear the where,
right,
and came in and tried to like be at a McDonald's, like order a McDonald's meal, and it was like clear McDonald's, right. So there was no way you could twist it, and the improvisers were really nervous then because they were like, oh, we were just in the ocean. And then Josh Patton comes out and he's like, guys, when are you going to get back to work? This McDonald's on an oil rig isn't going to run itself.
Oh,
and he was
really
like, we're
funny.
The only mid-Atlantic oil rig McDonald's. We got ships coming in for the lunch rush. Like, and it was just amazing. It was like in that little moment, everything was true.
Wow.
And everything worked. And everyone's idea was great. And we had a fun, fun scene. And we edited it. And it disappeared like they all do. But it was like, oh, God, nobody had to look like they didn't know what they were doing. Everything was great. And I realized, like, this is, like, our purpose. It's, like, to justify, to edit, and just to make everyone look awesome.
Yeah, we've all been a part of teams that hosted the jam. I think that is definitely a thing you learn when you're, like, you start to play very selflessly, and then you start to, like, be like, oh, my God, this is how improv, like, I can't believe I'm this good at improv. Like, it's honestly.
My improv got better, too. Like, I was just like, oh, this is, like, flying. Yeah.
Let's jump ahead to talking to you about teaching. You're a veteran teacher at the theater now.
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been teaching? Do you know how many years?
I don't know.
Five?
Probably about five
years?
Yeah.
We got some questions here. Let's ask you from our good friend Dave Murray. He asks the question, tangentials, What's cool about it?
Okay.
That's what
he said. So tangentials, I'm taking a short break from teaching this class, but I will teach it again.
This was an ASH you were teaching.
Yeah, Tangential Herald. So it's this form, basically, that I created being inspired by Jordan Klepper and a Matt Walsh workshop that I took.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Walsh were you in that? It was like a teacher workshop during DCM a couple years ago. It was really great. And he was talking about just like be funny, basically, like have fun, be funny. And he was talking in the teaching aspect about like calling audibles and stuff and like just feeling free to do all these things and waiver from the curriculum and blah, 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 if need be. But anyway, he was talking about how like basically what we were saying, like a technical second beat, like if something's funnier, do that, like kind of thing. And that was, Jordan was helping us a lot with that too at the time. Just like, just do what is
like allowing you guys to have the most fun.
Yeah. Like, and just like, and I say this a lot in all my classes, which is like, you're doing the Herald's not doing you.
Mm-hmm.
So like, don't be bound, you know, like break everything in a good way. Right. The structure's there to fuel you and make you even more creative. So, the tangential thing, I was like, oh, what if we did that on purpose? So it's like, every first beat, you just blow it out. You play it to its height. No tags, though, because that's confusing.
Right.
And then for the second beats, you on purpose don't play the same game. You take something else that's funny, and then you blow that game out, too.
Right.
So that by the end, you have six fully realized games plus your group games.
Right. So you have eight games to do third beats for.
And I call the third beats the cornucopia of dreams.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's when everything, because it's, I mean, you can realize every like dream you had for the Herald in that moment.
Right.
Because everything's at your fingertips. There's so many worlds that could collide. But so that was the origin. Matt Walsh and I was being coached by Jordan at the same time. And it was just like, let's do it.
Cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So things I can probably extrapolate from that are like, it's probably really fun doing third beats.
Oh my God. So fun.
So is there like, other than, I mean, you've taught this class, but like, what do you think about when it's like do third beats? You describe them as a cornucopia of dreams.
Yes.
How would you have students approach third beats in this class or in any class?
I mean, I really would challenge everybody to go running towards them. I think what happens is you do your second group game and then there's a big like,
we
have to do this.
There's
now.
The pressure of like, now we have to end the show.
Yeah. You like, go run, like run through the gate. And I feel like in Cornucopia of Dreams, it's mm-hmm. very easy because you've done so many games that there's just like so many characters. You just have to get it rolling. And in that specific class, I tell them to do 10 third beats.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, yeah, no. I tell them to do 10 third
audible
beats.
Audible Nerd Out by Nicole Dresbel.
10 third That's beats. Weird. And then like on the actual shows, I'll yeah. usually black them out before that. But mm-hmm. in class, I have them run 10 third beats.
Oh, so they're just foot on the pedal
to
the end.
The stuff that comes up with, like sometimes they even do more than that. And like you get to like 8 or 9 and they're amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And also there leaves you room for just like having fun. If you're just like, yeah. I just want to see that taxi driver who couldn't find her lipstick. Like, mm-hmm. that's if you just want to see that, you can see that for a second and
so
then move on.
Right. Are those third beats a combination of game third beats, orphan third beats, and connections?
Yeah.
And is there any emphasis or preference for one of those three?
No, I just want it to be the most fun as possible. Cool. And I just tell them not to burn stuff too much. Like if I was like, if you've burned it, like if you've done it, like if you did that, whatever, like taxi drive. An example I've been giving a lot is an anorexic cowboy because it makes me laugh and I don't know why.
Jesus.
Or like a cowboy with an eating disorder. It doesn't have to be anorexia. That's I just funny. Think it's really funny that a cowboy would be like caught up in like how many points they were eating mm-hmm. or something. But so anyway, like if you did anorexic cowboy mm-hmm. and then you like then do it again later, it's like only do it if you have a really good reason to later.
Right,
if you already
right,
did
right,
it.
Right, right.
Don't burn it too much. We're bored by it then. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But third beats in general, I think go running toward like run towards it. You're crafting this now. This yeah. is amazing.
There is this sort of like if you go into third beats and it feels timid at all, that's when the audience really starts to feel it.
It's right at the end.
If you miss an edit, it's like, ooh, it sucks the air out of the room.
Yeah, you gotta edit.
And you gotta edit.
That's my note. Edit.
Edit.
Edit. Yeah. I yell it enough.
But I would say the best third beats I've seen feel like they're almost going downhill in a way that it's like the momentum of the show yeah. is moving and everything's going.
I also will say just a random thing, like if you don't know what to do and there's that, just pick anything. Like I feel like I've heard that from so many coaches and I think it's right. Like mm-hmm. if that first beat, like set of beats that you did died, like then just go to the second, like you're in charge. Like get out there. This third beats. Get out there. Do something fun. Even yeah. if it's like a group game reference, like just get out there. I know there's an order to things
yeah.
For sure. But like, I think, I don't know that I'm not putting any sort of hard line
yeah,
down,
yeah,
but I'm
yeah.
just like, get out there. Jump on the grenade. Like you have to jump on the grenade.
Right.
So even if you're like, my scene sucks. Oh, well, that's what your
do
team
it.
Is for.
Yeah.
Get out there. If you don't know what to do with your first beat, have someone else get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Introducing a topic to the table.
Yeah.
Do it.
I do think third beats. I know I teach this way, so I shouldn't necessarily attribute it to everybody, but I know I'm guilty of it. I think third beats get treated like such an afterthought. Like, I know when I'm teaching a 401 class, sometimes it's like, oh, God, the exercise in the first half ran long. We barely have enough time for two heralds. And
you
I'm kind of like,
get to it,
right? Barely get to it. And then
true.
I barely talk about it.
Yeah.
And there is
true.
One third beat exercise in 401, which I tend not to do.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, I just feel like it is. It's the point of your show. It's what your show is moving towards. But it ends up getting treated like an epilogue.
Yeah.
Like second beats end up being what we really talk about
right.
during the show. Yeah.
Like
during the herald.
When we mention third beats is kind of in the second beat drill in
yeah.
301. And then I guess there's one in 401.
Yeah. Which is good. The
something
gauntlet.
I do all the time, and it might not lead to really strong third beats.
Yeah.
Because it is more like flashes of fun versus like sturdy third beat, like. Connection, but is when I have I actually do this in 201. I was gonna say I do it for my advanced mm-hmm. classes, but I do towards the end of 201. I have them do it after warm up scenes. I have them do third beats of their warm up scenes.
Ooh,
so that they do connections.
Cool,
during their
and
scenes.
They probably have
that's
the
really
mind,
cool.
and you just tell them to have the mindset of like run towards the fun.
Yeah, I think you
I'm
just have
to steal that.
Yeah, do it. I think it's yeah, and I think it's just jumping on the grenade. You have to. I think another thing that maybe I'm not saying, and maybe this is why like. You have to trust your team or
right.
your class.
Right.
So if I don't know what to do, say I'm playing like a I don't know, like a happy coyote or something, and mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. I don't have a third beat, but I'm the happy coyote and I'm first and I have to go. I have to just
yeah,
get out there and trust that somebody's going
to
be.
Seven people are there to
yeah,
help
that's
you.
Their job. I came out on a second beat once and I couldn't remember. I blanked. And I remember Morgan being so amazing and her just like being a I was at a doctor's office and I blanked on my premise and she was just like, do you have the tubes?
And, you're like,
and I was like, no,
yeah.
She's like, I need tubes to do this procedure. I'm going to go see if we have any tubes. And then she like went into another room and Ryan was there. She's like, I need that. And he's like, tubes. And she's like, yes, I need these tubes. And we just did this really funny beat about tubes. And it wasn't a proper second beat because I blanked on my premise.
But you did a scene.
We did a scene and it was really funny. And I was just like, oh, right. Like that's everyone's, every scene is everyone's job.
Here's what also makes that great, I think, because I feel like sometimes as coaches or as improvisers, we'd encourage people to like redirect you towards what the proper game was for that second beat. And I think if that can happen, that's an awesome skill set.
That's great if that can happen.
But I think it's more important to continue to push the cart where the cart's already going, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like if somebody had walked on, like if Drew Johnston had walked on and like a minute into the tubes thing was like, ugh, guys, I'm going to make the tubes thing a real true second beat.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that would suck.
Maybe.
I picked Drew specifically because Drew's neutral.
It's one of those things that I think, it's one of those
you know,
things
but
that
I think that would
up.
Be you pulling the show back to the show and not towards your team.
It's one of those things that has come up in this podcast a lot where it's supporting the teammate and not the show or the game.
Yeah, the group. I think that happens most times during group games where someone thinks it's the second group game and it's actually a third beat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That happens. That's like, I think, the most common structural mistake that happens. Mm-hmm. And it's going to always happen. Like, it'll just happen. It's just a mistake and it happens. But that's where that, I think, crucial decision happens. And everyone, and it's usually like, what do we do? Do we support this and make this the group game or do we find a way to reroute it? Yeah. And it's just, it's always a gut decision. Cause sometimes you can come in there with a perfect line and fix it, but most of the time you can't. And I made that switch happen once. And I was, it was like a scene at a car and I was like, oh my God, we're in the third beat or third scene. I thought we were in the group game.
Yeah.
And same deal. Team just supported it. And then after I like apologized and they're like, no apologies. We don't apologize. We just support. And I was like, oh, I don't have to apologize either. Why am I apologizing?
It's one of those things that I think, especially at the 301 level, people are starting to understand the right thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who are, you know, a little bit behind as far as understanding or being able to apply it. And you see a lot of it in 301. And I constantly feel like I'm saying to my 301 students, like, guys, be able to roll with the punches.
Yeah.
Like, if a mistake happens, it happened.
Yeah.
It's improv.
We're grown-ups playing pretend.
Yeah.
Like, get on board.
I want to go back to third beats for a second.
Oh, sure.
Also, throwing this out there for the group, do you think third beats get shortchanged because all across the community, both at the two UCB theaters and also in the indie community, we're too concerned about time. How much time we have for each set, how much turnover between shows,
yes.
How much time do we have at our Under St. Mark show? We have to do four teams. They each get 12 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
Like, is it that because we're more concerned about time than form, we're shortchanging form?
I think time's a big factor in teaching, I would say.
Yes, for sure.
If you're running two heralds in a second half of class and there's been like a lot of questions, but keep asking questions. Always ask questions.
Yeah.
But there's like a lot of questions or a lot of talking in the first half, like I'm totally guilty of this too, where you're like, okay, I edit on like the first great connection or whatever, instead of like letting things run because we got to get that other group up. I will say though, like, I think this is shifting now because Shannon's really having people do like proper third beats at the end of their shows.
Game
I think that's
based
like,
third beats.
Yeah, I think that's super important. That's giving the third beats weight, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like you can't just slap a connection together and get a blackout. So I think that will probably shift things a lot.
I already like that in my. I get to say to my classes,
"This is how
Shannon
it's,
says you have
oh,
to do
I say
game
it to everybody." So wait,
whatever we can just pawn off on higher ups.
I agree with that partly. The reason that I think that it gets shortchanged sometimes in classes is because, like, for me, I'm always looking at it like, okay, well, the first and second beats weren't that good, so like, asking them to do proper third beats is difficult without addressing the problems in the first and second beat.
Yeah, you're right.
But like with Harold Knights and Lloyd Knights, I think time is a factor.
Yeah.
Because they definitely can do the third beats. It's like we just gotta, you know, time starts running and people are looking at the clock. It's for sure different, I think, in different
ways. There is a thing though of like figure it out. Like if you had a shitty first beat, then you have to figure out how
totally.
To have a great second
That's
beat.
True.
And you have to figure out how to have a third beat. Like there is something to squirming and figuring out how you can that thing of like, you're in charge of it. Make it good. Find a way to make it good.
Yeah. I do tell a lot of 401 classes, your Herald's not over. I don't care that you had a bad opening. I don't care that you had bad first beats.
Yeah, you have to
I don't care. At any point in time, you are capable of turning your show around. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes it'll be like bad pattern game, bad herald. We're stuck in it now for 25 minutes.
Yeah. That's a
you could have a terrible herald and murder your third beats.
Yeah,
it's
you
doable.
Really can't. I've seen it done. Yeah. And I think people, too, are like that thing of like being of use. Like that means you have to look outside of your scene work and look at the piece.
Yes.
And if you're doing it, hopefully with the spirit that we should all be doing it with, you should be looking at nurturing each and every scene. And a lot of times that's just getting out of the way and not stepping on or something. But like if I need to step on, how can I help? Right. So it's like, how can I help? How can I help? So then you should be looking at it as a piece.
Right.
And therefore, you should be able to tell, like, whoa, we've had two scenes that are so low energy. I better just start this first scene differently. Like,
question.
Totes.
And this is something that I wanted to ask earlier. What opening do you do in your tangential herald classes?
I usually do an opening.
Ooh, I love an opening.
An opening. I was in London teaching and I said an opening and they were like, oh my God. They like loved that idea that it was an opening. I started doing it with openings and then it felt like, because I was asking so much of them, it felt like an extra
thing to teach.
And just like, I almost felt like they didn't need it. It was almost better to just organically let the suggestion be whatever these are. I think scene painting works really good with it because you're just painting the space of the first three scenes.
And you're still sort of organically finding the game.
Yeah. And you're just, I like scene painting. When I started, I was doing it with monologues a lot too, just to give a little something, but it almost felt like, it just felt a little too much. So I kind of prefer an opening. Sometimes it's better. I kind of just let, I teach it with an opening and then I'll tack one on. And see what we think.
Yeah.
And I tend to just let the class decide what they would prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had other class in my 401 classes when we go over openings and stuff too. I do the same thing where I'm like, what do you want? Like, what do you want to do for your show? Yeah.
Are your second beats initiated with a premise from a different weird thing from that first beat, or are they initiated organically with like half an idea from that first beat?
It can be either. Mm-hmm. So it can be, I say whenever an extra person's in that first beat, it's really fun to do that. Like if you're at a restaurant and a waiter comes by, it might be really fun to just
see
like live
waiter.
That waiter's life for a second. Yeah. And in that aspect, it might not be that the waiter like has a premise. It might just be like, oh my God, that waiter, it was so funny. He like limped to the table every time, but never really talked about it. So like maybe, but actually then I am really starting with a premise. I'm like, Gary, you have to go home.
You can't
keep coming into work. You know, you need your insurance, but you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then we play that and Gary's like accident prone and we watch him wait tables for the second beat. So I think they tend to be premise sort of like in, when we teach monologues and we talk about chaff and how it's like, oh, it's just a memorable detail. But those tend to always be the most premise-y fun
ones. If you do
like
a little bit of thinking in your head, you can figure it
out.
I also just realized that your form is probably very well laid for connections because there's already a connection between two of the games.
That's
like
true.
The waiter.
It's not that hard.
On. Yeah, it's like the
it's
yeah.
Not
you do
that
a,
hard to connect.
That's very interesting.
And it's also fun too because every beat that you do also has fun tangents in it.
Yeah,
so you can
also
show that. You know, so there's a lot.
Let me ask you maybe a final hypothetical here, Lydia.
Cool. Hypothetical.
Now, you have a student that maybe you're mentoring or a student that...
I'm not mentoring
You're not
anyone.
Mentoring anyone.
Do not ask me to mentor
this
you.
This is a hypothetical.
Is that real?
No.
No. This is a hypothetical.
No, I don't get mentor
I got so
requests.
Excited. No, but I mean like, are you really not interested in being anybody's mentor?
No.
No,
well, I'm still asking my
hypothetical. I'm not interested in mentoring.
Because, oh, God, I love that. I can't wait to talk to you about how you put up those walls when this podcast is over.
I'm asking you this question because right now your answer might be mentoring the listeners, right?
Yes. No, I mean, I care about my students.
Course,
I just don't want to like teach them how to be a person.
I shouldn't have said mentoring.
No, I'm just kidding.
You,
this is going away.
You have,
this is going off the rails.
You have a student that's good.
Yes.
And they get things and they're technically good.
Yeah.
Maybe a young Lydia Hensler.
Oh.
What piece of advice would you give them where you're like, oh man, I wish someone had told me this? Like there's always something, like going back, I'm always like, God, I wish someone had just told me not to walk onto scenes direct. I mean, they probably did. I wasn't listening. But,
right. but like, no, I wish they told me to listen.
But the reason I ask is because there's always this note that I think we get early on, and then when we become teachers and coaches, we're always looking for it and always trying to like push it. And like that's the one for me, and I wonder if there's one that sticks out for you where you're like, I want you guys to not fall down the same trappings that I did.
I think it would be somewhere in the world of like trusting yourself. Because it was like, I would have the confidence to initiate a scene or whatever, but somewhere along the way early on, I just questioned my choices. I'd get nervous.
Do you think you trusted your teams more than you trusted yourself at any point? Because I feel like there are definitely improvisers where I see you, I'm like, man, you really trust your team, but you won't like be behind your own
idea. I did that. When I would say for the first year and a half on Bastion, I was nervous. I was with all these really lovely people who I had no reason to be nervous, but I was very nervous. And I trusted them. But I would get scared. I don't even know if it was like I didn't trust myself as much as I was putting. I give this note a lot too of like, don't put pressure on yourself.
Right.
Excuse me. To make it work. Like that's what your scene partner is there for too. Like just build together. And I think I would just like, I didn't want to fuck it up. Like I just don't fuck up this scene, you know? And I would just get nervous. Like I would question my own. I would just question my intuition. And I don't know if it's experience improvising and just like life experience. It's like I don't question my intuition about fucking anything anymore. Right. And it's like, oh, if I walked on and then later I was like, I wish I didn't walk on. Oh, well, next time I won't because this feeling will come up. Like, I think we can all trust our guts. We kind of have it in 101. Like, you have a gut in 101. And so, like, that was my note was like, trust my gut. And I would second guess myself. And that,
you can probably
everything.
Pick out a player who's going through that kind of thing too and be like, hey, you know, I understand what you're doing and I understand how you're going through it.
I think I will often find in classes, I would say every few classes I'll find like every third or fourth class, I'll find like one or two people who are really good and are getting either looked over, not listened to, or are too nervous to confidently say their lines. And that's the third one's more where I sort of would fall into place. I think I would come off nervous, and that's not good. I'd be confident enough to do everything, but not confident enough to be sure of what I was doing.
it's interesting because it probably doesn't even get thought about that much. Because most of the time, the thing we're noting is the person who's too confident that doesn't trust anyone else.
It's like, oh my God, would you stop talking
so
for 2 seconds?
It's interesting.
Partner. I think it's less about, I think it's more, I think sometimes my role as a teacher is just to like tell that, like, hey, you're funny. Like, don't be afraid of yourself. Like, come out, do the scene.
Wow. Well, God, I feel like this was, and this is going to sound like a bit. One of the more useful episodes of the podcast.
Oh,
we had so
yay.
Many great little pieces of advice, and you're a wealth of information when it comes to improv and teaching and performing. What a story. Two teams in 10 years. Jesus Christ.
That's crazy.
You might be the only. I mean, that is insane.
That is weird.
Absolutely insane. thank you so much for being our guest, Lydia.
Thank you. Bye. Yay.
You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversation podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and do that. And you can also go to iTunes and leave a rating or review. That would really help us out. In the future, if you want to ask us questions or ask questions to our guests, you can follow us on Twitter at UCB Convo and look for postings there on future guests and future activity. Guys, I'm feeding the nerds left and right. We'll see you next week.